Welcome to a brand new episode of Seize the Moment podcast. And today we have a very special guest. We have Ed Simon. He's the executive director of Bell Media Collaborative and editor-in-chief of literary journal Belt Magazine. He's a staff writer for LitHub, and his essays and criticism have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Paris Review Daily, The New Republic, The Washington Post, and Aeon. His new book, available July 9th, is called Devil's Contract: The History of the Faustian Bargain. Ed, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you guys.
Absolutely. And so to read a passage from Ed's book, he wrote, "The figure of Faust is, after Christ, Mary, and the devil, the single most popular character in the history of Western Christian culture," writes Jeffrey Burton Russell in his classic Metastopheles, "The Devil in the Modern World." And of those characters, Faust is the most fully human to us in his arrogance and his failure, his negotiations and his capitulations, and his whole litany of abuse which the cankered soul is capable of inflicting upon itself. Russell's contention is far from hyperbole. And amending the word character to narrative, I'd say that there are few archetypal scripts in our culture as essential as the legend of a man selling his soul to the devil. Thousands of works of literature and film, music and art grapple with the bargain whereby somebody trades what's most human for power or wealth, influence or knowledge. Only the myth of Adam and Eve being cast out of Eden competes with Faust in terms of influence, and that story is arguably an early variation on the devil's contract, which is what makes the relative dearth of critical treatments of the variable legend so surprising. Okay, so first, before we even get into that and how academia has treated it over the years, can you actually get into the story of Faust? Tell us a little bit about it. So, I mean, obviously, we're not going to get into the entire thing, but pretty much sort of the major plot lines of it, and also why you found it to be so captivating.
Sure, sure. So I guess the skeleton plot of the Faust legend is exemplified by that title, Devil's Contract. So it's basically any story in its broad parameters that has somebody who contractually sells their soul to the devil, whether it's Satan or some other demon, in exchange for some kind of power. So frequently that is knowledge. Sometimes it's, financial success or romantic success even. But the idea is that the most intrinsic human elemental part of yourself has been traded so that you can acquire something that you otherwise wouldn't be able to acquire on your own. And then eventually that debt comes due and the devil takes you off to where you go, where the devil reigns. And sometimes in some variations of the myth, the devil's successful, sometimes he's not. But that's the broad parameters of the myth. And that goes back a long way in our culture. I mean, I argue in my book that there are even earlier versions of things that in a really archetypal way kind of match this. But the first, where you actually have like a contract that's like written in blood and parchment in a very kind of like stereotypical way, goes back to medieval morality plays of like the 12th century. But it's most identified with this guy named Faust, who, as far as we can tell, was probably a historical person, though we don't know much about him. 16th century German alchemist and magician. He supposedly sold his soul to the devil and was cast off into hell at the end of his life. Lots of anonymous pamphlets and sort of tracts were written about him. And it's Christopher Marlowe, the English playwright, who really associates that name with the legend, with a play that comes out in the 1590s. And then you have thousands of permutations of that legend, from high and low culture, canonical works to kind of like, B movies. Every medium has had some sort of exploration of that broad, broad myth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like just kind of going through just the story, the play, any of those kind of variations of it. I mean, it seems to be this very black and white version of morality. I'm assuming for the most part, in most of these tales, it is based on the Judeo-Christian version of it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Certainly in like the European traditions. I mean, I think that it's in more contemporary versions, it's branched out or kind of played with that myth in a way that kind of separates it from those Christian origins. But the earliest variations on the myth were explicitly Christian, and they had a very kind of moralizing, don't have too much fun kind of tone to them. Mm-hmm. Be careful, keep your pride in check, keep your avarice in check, lest you exchange what is most important in making you for stuff that are just kind of like the trifles of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what I found very interesting is that in the book, you actually go through a lot of ancient sort of myths to modern literature and different historical artifacts to sort of outline how the Faustian bargain is sort of present there. Which, out of the ones discussed in the book, which did you find sort of the most, I would say, surprising to you or most interesting to you?
And this is probably true going into the book itself. And I guess I didn't really, and I can kind of address the earlier question that you had about what made me interested in this legend. So this is something, this is a book that I've wanted to write for like 20 years. It was, you know, when I got into academe, I had this kind of idea that like, oh, when I do my, you know, dissertation, it can be this history of the Faust legend, not being aware that when you do a dissertation, they tend to be much more kind of like granular and specific. And this is not the sort of writing that really lends itself to what people do in academe. But I always had this kind of like torch I carried for writing this project. And I think it's just because it's so evocative to me because, you know, it's kind of a legend that has everything to a certain extent. Plus, it's one of those things where the devil always gets the best tunes, right? Like Satan is always an interesting character. But the center of the story is a man. Right. I mean, he might have supernatural abilities that are granted to him or what have you, but he's not like a demigod. He's not an angel. He's not a monster. He's a like a flesh and blood human being. So I find his way in that how he intersects with these kind of grander, sacred, to use that term broadly, kind of transcendental things to be really, really fascinating to me. In terms of the version that I think I've found to be most attractive, because they're not all created equal, obviously, right? Like I always joke that like the Charlie Daniels band's The Devil Went Down to Georgia is not like Goethe, right? Like we very broadly have the same story, but they're doing very, very different things and have a very, very different influence. I think that the Marlowe play was and remains my favorite iteration of it. Marlowe himself is such a captivating figure. He's a tremendous writer. He's, you know, only rivaled by Shakespeare at the time period in terms of the greatness of his kind of lines that he wrote. And his version of Faust is interesting because it exists in two different forms. So you have an earlier form that came out when he was still alive, and then you have a slightly longer form that came out after he died. There's some major differences between them. Scholars don't really know which one's authoritative, if either of them are. And I think that being able to look at those differences between the texts is really fascinating. And it's a way of kind of, I think, emphasizing how much of this is a story that is always apt for continual rewriting and continual revision. So it's a story that can be told over and over again, but it can be told in slightly different ways all the time. And I think that in and of itself is a fascinating aspect of this as a legend.
Yeah, what I love so much about it, and I want to hear both of your perspectives on this too, especially as that relates to both of you and your lives in particular. So what I love about it so much is when you think about Faust, he's just like, I think he's a very relatable character, at least to me. And so the reason why I say that is there was a period in my life where I was pretty obsessed with like new age type thinking. And I love, by the way, that you cover Gnosticism, because I was super obsessed with Gnosticism for about like 10 years of my life.
Yeah.
So,
it
and
pulls
I remember
you in, Gnosticism.
Yes. Oh my God. Because it's so does, like contrarian. Yeah. And it's also like secretive, you know, and you're like digging in through the, So, and what I loved about it is like, it kind of like, as you're reading through it, you're kind of like looking for hidden treasure, like these hidden secrets of life. Right. And so what I really loved about Faust is that like when I'm kind of, you know, in my own way, and when I'm identifying with him, it sort of brought me back to that time in my life where I thought, okay. And obviously I'm not like, I'm not as let's say as he is in the story where he's like this genius who's poured over God like thousands of literature, right? Obviously I haven't done that, but my point is to say that why I identified with him so much is I remember after pouring over all the spiritual literature, and then on top of that the more secular stuff too, I remember I was left wondering like, what the fuck is the point of all of this? So yeah. I know all of this stuff now, it's not really very useful to me. I don't feel like I know some deep secret about life or anything, at least worth really, I don't know, considering for more than like 10 minutes. And then on top of that I'm thinking like, maybe this is all kind of pointless, right? It's sort of repetitive, right? Which is a term used in the book. And then on top of that, it feels as though it's all kind of going nowhere. So I can imagine myself being in a situation where somebody comes to me, you know, the devil or whomever, somebody of high power, and they say, look, I know this, like this ordinary life, it's not for you. You know, like you've gone through all of it. And in some ways, you know, you've kind of transcended it, or you at least can transcend it, right? So I can see why that could be so tempting for him. So when we look at Faust, it's so easy to look at him as like, you know, like this sort sort of a bad character, at least in the beginning of the story, as somebody who's, I don't know, let's say kind of trying to live above his lot or live above his means. But I'm wondering, like, first of all, A, why isn't that okay? And B, I would wonder, like, isn't that a human thing that all of us kind of tend to do? Isn't it that for the most part, when we think of the mundane, like, and I know for some people, we could think of it as, oh, lack of gratitude or whatever. But if we are being honest with ourselves as humans, like, isn't it something that we're kind of bored with and wanting to kind of get out of, right? So, I mean, like, I want to hear from you guys, like, what you both think of Faust and, like, if there's a part of you that identifies with him as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's actually, you'd probably be interested to know that the working title of this book was The Autobiography of Dr. Faust. And my conceit was that his story is our story, exactly for the reasons that you just enumerated, right? Like, I think he's a tremendously sympathetic character. I mean, I think anyone who said that they didn't see a bit of themselves in him would have to be either a much better person than me or lying, right? Like, I think that there's a certain amount of, like, he wants a shortcut, that's part of it, but there's also a dissatisfaction or an incompleteness that I think you express so well. And in that sense too, I think he's a particularly modern person, right? And I really like this idea of him as, like, a spiritual seeker, because it's true that in the beginning of the Marlowe play, but also the Goethe poem and a lot of works of it, he's, like, mastered all of these other things. He's mastered medicine and the law and theology. And he feels kind of an emptiness or a yearning, right? You got to remember that Marlowe's writing at a point too, right, where the possibility of a type of, like, secularism is emerging. So the kind of, like, old certainties of religion don't quite do it anymore, or it's the very beginning of that kind of thing. And so that he is then turning to more esoteric or occult ways to find meaning, which he doesn't really. Like, he kind of finds physical and sensual enjoyments and all sorts of things and powers. But ultimately, he doesn't necessarily gratify himself with any knowledge that he didn't necessarily have at the outset. But I think that in that way, he's almost like he's like an existential hero or something. I mean, he comes across like a character from the 20th century. And I think I think he's kind of the character of a lot of those other figures that emerge in writings over the past 400 years.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, if I had to think about in my personal life where I could sort of relate to Faust is, so back in the day, and I forget how old I was. I forgot if it was my early 20s or slightly before that. I was really into, I don't know if you guys know this term, like dark psychology. Like
I don't know what that is. What is that?
Okay. All right. Sorry. It's a cult. No, I'm just kidding. So essentially, it's just a coined term for using sort of psychological tactics to maybe get an edge up in conversations with other people in certain contexts, right? Like, for example, I'll give you an example. Let's say this term of like mirroring and matching. So supposedly, if you are mirroring and matching someone's movements, you'll build rapport with them.
Oh, I see.
Little things like that, or knowing that if you get someone to talk about themselves, people love to talk about themselves. So you just ask them
So it's like how to influence.
Essentially, yeah. And trying to use all these little tactics to get an edge up because I felt like I was somehow lacking and not enough, essentially. Okay, so that actually did work. However, it was not fulfilling because I wasn't actually having sort of genuine relationships with these people. Right. It was essentially just me trying to kind of just architect my way to just, again, get that edge up. So, I mean, in a way, I was trading my ability to truly relate to other people to have sort of like a fake way of doing it. And it wasn't worth it in the end. And then I just realized, oh, okay, you know, oh, you are enough. You don't need tactics. You know, this you don't need to be necessarily ego-driven trying to, you know, get something from someone.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about that? So for Ed, and I wonder kind of where you find yourself within the spectrum, because I feel like I'm identifying more with the pre-Faust, the beginning version of it, where he's kind of like dissatisfied with life. And he's like, okay, you know what, there has to be much more to this, like what's out there, right? And you're more of the post, right? You're more of the person that says, well, you know, I kind of see that these like ways of the world or whatever are not necessarily too savory.
Well, I mean, I definitely was very pre-Faust in that sense.
Yeah,
actually, I don't know if I'm still, I'm sorry, I couldn't really, I don't want to be daring and say I'm post-Faust.
Well, as you sound like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it, mm-hmm. but a lot of people can say, you know, you have to mm-hmm. sort of embody that. Mm-hmm. And somebody can say that, but you have to, if you're really honest with yourself, maybe there are moments when you identify as post-Faust, mm-hmm. like, you know, you might vacillate.
Yeah, right, right.
Between, I think that's like, the way, I mean, it's that kind of like negative capability, right? That sort yeah. of idea that you have these, you know, contradictions everyone does that are like yeah. within our psyche, that like sometimes we're pre-Faust, sometimes we're post-Faust. I mean, I write a lot about religion. It's kind of my beat, and people like to make a big game out of figuring out what my own kind of like religious commitments are, and my answer is always like, ask me on any given day and they'll be different. Like sometimes I'm an atheist, sometimes I'm God intoxicated, sometimes it's like in the space of an hour, right? And I think that that can happen in all kinds of different ways, and I definitely have moments when I like, I think failable human moments when I very much commiserate with kind of the pre-Mephistopheles Faust, and then maybe depending on which version of the legend you read too, either he finds his salvation or he doesn't, you know. And maybe at my best I think I've found it, but then what is the thing, you know, you think you found it and you know that you haven't. So mm-hmm. I don't know, I mean, that's what I love about this legend, is it's sort of it's kaleidoscopic, it's ever changing, right? Morally and ethically, how you want to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's so interesting in the context of religion is most of the time these godlike deities, I mean, especially in ancient Greek culture, but obviously even in kind of pre-Christian definitely, but then even in Christian Judeo, you have these godlike figures who are actually more human than not, at least, you know, on the surface. So can we actually talk about the beginning of the story and how this wager actually happens with God? And again, how the seemingly kind of like human nature actually, in terms of the conflict and the dyad between God and Satan, actually manifests itself too.
Oh, yeah. And what's fascinating is, I mean, the way in which the Faust legend has built itself, a lot of times it's by recourse to the story of Job. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have a variation whereby the reason why Faust is tempted is the same reason why Job is tortured in the mm-hmm. Hebrew scriptures. And that's because the devil made a bet with God about it, mm-hmm. right? And it's such a fundamentally disturbing story, the story of Job. I mean, I think I don't know if anyone's ever written like a cultural history of Job. I'm sure somebody has. Somebody
Carl Jung did, actually. Yeah. Carl Jung did. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's you know, when you mentioned about how human the sort of Judeo-Christian gods are, I mean, I'm sorry, how the sort of Greco-Roman gods are. I think one of the interesting things with the God in the Hebrew scriptures is that he's kind of a complicated human figure in a way that is not often acknowledged, right? So sometimes when we think of the Greco-Roman gods, like they kind of signify certain things and they're kind of like broad character types or personality types. Mm-hmm. But the God in the Hebrew scriptures is oftentimes so contradictory in the way that like a person is, right? Mm-hmm. He can be erratic, he can be capricious, he can be kind, he can be loving, he can be hateful. He's kind of all over the place. And the reason for that, like as an editorial reason, is obviously because different people had different understandings of what this one God would be like, and the whole thing was redacted and edited together into a thing that is kind of like a contradictory mess in some ways, but then mm-hmm. also prefigures the novelistic imagination in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So that God, that character of God in the Bible is almost... he's almost fit for a novel. He's fit for a different type of literature than the type of literature of the time period in which he was written. Where this becomes interesting with Job is there's a fantastic book by a guy named Jack Miles, if you've ever encountered this, and it's called God, A Biography. Mm-hmm. Came out in the early 90s, was a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was a former Jesuit priest, and he said that he was just going to interpret the character of God from a literary perspective. So no theology, no philosophy, just how do we read the personality of this character? And he specifically looked at the way in which God is depicted in the Tanakh, in the Jewish ordering of the Old Testament, where the order of the books is different from how it is in the Christian version. And one of the things he notes is that the last time God ever speaks in the Tanakh is in Job. It's the mm-hmm. last time he shows up. So to remind your listeners of the plot of Job, you know, Job is this uprighteous standing man. The devil at the beginning basically bets God that he can make Job turn on God by putting all these misfortunes and tribulations upon him, because the devil argues that it's easy to love God if everything's going your way. So horrible stuff happens to Job, like he's struck with disease and his family dies and his animals die. And at the very end, Job doesn't quite curse God, but he asks God, like, why did you do this to me? God comes out of the whirlwind. He gives this tremendous speech about like how he was, you know, created the firmament and he separated the night from the day. And like, who are you, small man, to even question me? And Job's like, you're right. Who am I? And then he gets everything back threefold, but that means, you know, new kids and a new wife and everything. So it's always had that kind of dark glimmer to it. But what Miles makes the point of is Job never knows why God lets the devil do what he does. But we as the readers absolutely do, because we're told at the beginning that it was because God himself sort of felt, gave in to a Faustian bargain of sorts, right? And that's a fundamentally disturbing metaphysic. Like, what we do with that is difficult to say. But Miles says, whether it was intentional or not, the fact that that's the last time God speaks in the Hebrew Scriptures is notable, because from then on out, people, even if they mention God or they do things by recourse to God, are basically kind of on their own to a certain extent, which is certainly an idiosyncratic reading, but I think a fascinating one. And it's one that's definitely kind of like influenced how I think about these particular issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so going back to the bargain between God and Satan and Faust.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, like, you know, one of the ways, and I don't really mention much about Job in the book, I kind of like touch on it a bit, but it kind of posits that you have like a Faustian bargain at the center of reality itself, right? Mm-hmm. Where God has kind of been the one to sign. God has sort of sold his soul, if we can speak of it in that way, to the devil, at least in that moment, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a way in which Faust then, you know, builds upon that legend, or kind of makes it, kind of puts it in a different direction, but it's still fundamentally structured by that original story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also seems like God, and again in Faust and in Job, like he's always testing humanity, and it always makes you question, you know, like I don't know, maybe this is deeper than what we want to get into in terms of the religious context here, but it's like it always makes you question, like, if God created people, why does he constantly have to test them? Like, what is the point of this, and why does he always get mad at Satan for saying, hey, by the way, I think your creation is shit and I'm gonna prove it to you? He's like, no, fuck you, I'm gonna prove to you that you're wrong. Like, why does it have to keep going back and forth with that?
And that's always, like, you know, the fundamental question of theodicy, right, of the problem of evil is, like, how does Satan answer to God in this whole, you know, is he a creature of God? Was he made by God? Is he doing things of his own accord, but then God's supposed to be omnipotent? How do you square all of these things? And of course, there's, like, thousands of different ways that theologians have answered that question, but the question itself still fundamentally remains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, plus I suppose you could think of Satan as sort of symbolizing temptation, or maybe, I don't know if you want to take, you know, stretch this far, but like essentially our own ego in a way, right?
I think, like, that totally works. You know, one of the things I write about in the introduction is this production of Faust that I saw like 15 years ago, and the way in which they performed it. So the actor that played Faust also played Mephistopheles, and he put on this kind of like weird minotaur Moloch mask thing. And it was strongly implied that Mephistopheles was like an attribute of his own psyche. And I think that's absolutely a way that that can be read, as kind of his baser desires or his appetites. I mean, in the Pali Canon, in the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha is tempted by Mara, who's kind of a Mephistophelian figure, right? And that's the same sort of, it's an incredibly similar story, right? So I think it does speak to something intrinsic in the way that we have different levels to our psyche, some of which are directed towards higher things and some of which aren't, and there's a tension there.
Yeah, so then I suppose then if we could, you know, attribute to the devil or Mephistopheles, you know, as being, let's say, the ego or a negative aspect, I suppose, of one's psyche, then I suppose you could also argue that God is, for lack of a better way of phrasing this, only because it's not coming to me, I suppose your higher self, your, you know, your like better nature.
Like an id super ego kind of thing, almost.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, like, yeah. I mean, in relation to your question, because you said, oh, why is God always, you know, testing you? Yeah. I don't know if, I mean, it does. Yes, that is how it's portrayed people are being tested. But then I suppose when you have that conflict between, you know, the lower part of your nature, let's say the ego, and then the higher part, I mean, that's sort of almost like an internal conflict within ourselves when you look at the God versus that.
Can I ask you a question? So are you then saying that your, I mean, obviously maybe this is me just putting words in your mouth, but are you saying then your interpretation is, so if we were to apply what I was just saying earlier, so would your interpretation be that with God doesn't trust people, it's essentially like in some ways that part of ourselves that's like our higher selves that's in conflict with ourselves because we don't trust ourselves?
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
No, because I don't know, at least the way that I'm sort of characterizing it, I mean, probably that version of God that at least I'm talking about probably wouldn't have a mistrust of people.
Unless
the way
human.
I'm characterizing it, at least. So no, there's a flaw here. There's obviously there are holes that could be poked in how I'm framing it, especially in the context of different portrayals of God and the devil.
Yeah.
So I was just trying to use that as sort of a framework for kind of looking at an internal conflict between ourselves as like, you know, like when you think of the God versus the devil, you almost think of like this, you know, higher nature versus lower nature in yourself. That's
and
all.
This is now a great segue, I think, into Gnosticism, because for the Gnostics, it was actually what you're describing. So for the Gnostics, God particularly was kind of like this essence, and it wasn't something so much that was out there as, you know, obviously within you. And so there was this kind of internal battle that was always raging, right? So Ed, can you now tell us about how Gnosticism, first of all, plays a role in all of this,
sure.
Who Simon Magus was, and how he was the forerunner of Faust?
Absolutely. So, the Gnostics are one of these like fascinating groups of people. I know that in like modern day parlance, a lot of times the term itself, Gnosticism, isn't even used as much because there's this argument that there's all these very diverse groups that are kind of thrown together under one tent. I'm not a scholar of like first, second, third century Christianity. I still think it's a useful, at least in like a popular book kind of phrase. And what it refers to is basically this collection of dozens, if not hundreds, of really bizarre, nominally Christian sects that existed in the first few centuries of Christianity. Some of them are more Jewish, some are more pagan, but what they're all really basically united by is a belief that the world that we live in was the creation of a lesser deity, of a demiurge, and that this demiurge is in some ways kind of satanic or infernal. And this is a way of explaining why everything seems, for lack of a better term, irrevocably fucked in the world, right? Like, if you have an all-good, all-powerful God, then why is the world so obviously not perfect? And again, there's all sorts of different solutions to that in conventional religion, but the Gnostics came up with one that basically said, because it wasn't made by God, it was made by this lesser, malevolent deity, and the actual God is, like, so great and grand that he doesn't even necessarily notice, at least initially, that all of this has happened. And oftentimes, the malicious God was identified directly with the God of the Old Testament, which, of course, had a lot of problems for lowercase O Orthodox Christians, because the Gnostics were basically saying the God which they worshipped was the devil. And so you have all of these different, and the demiurge has different names depending on which sect you're talking about. Sometimes, as you know, like the cosmology gets like insanely baroque. You have like different levels and angels, and it's insanely complicated. Simon Magus is a figure who is oftentimes associated with being like the first Gnostic or the founder of Gnosticism. He most definitely wasn't. We don't know if there was a historical Simon Magus or not. He's mentioned in the book of Acts in the New Testament. And what he is there is basically like a wizard or a necromancer. He's a Samaritan, so he's not Jewish. He's from a different group that's in that relative part of the world, that region. And we're told that he wants to be baptized so that he can perform magic, which is a strange idea, right? Like, what do we, like, baptism is like a kind of a cult immersion or something. So he acknowledges the truth of Christianity as expressed in the New Testament, but wants to use it for his own kind of like selfish purposes. And there's he's only mentioned this like one time in the book of Acts, but there's a huge apocryphal literature about him, oftentimes written by people who themselves were very conventionally religious or sort of the winners of what would happen. But in one book called The Acts of Peter and Paul, which is not canonical, but there's nothing in it that's necessarily heretical, it's said that Peter was fighting Simon in Rome. They have like a prayer battle, basically. Mm-hmm. Simon, who has been baptized, so he's a Christian technically, he uses the powers he gets from God to sort of fly about in the air. Peter, who is of greater faith, prays him to the ground, and he hits the ground, and that's the end of Simon Magus. So this figure, who may or may not have existed, is then kind of all of the heretics are lumped together as being in some way associated with him. He's kind of the earliest variation on the Faust myth in some way, because he's a definite personage who is using this sort of religious magic for power. But what's interesting in the Simon Magus story is he's not deriving that power from the devil. He's deriving it from God misused, right? Which is like, why would God let that happen? What does that mean? You know, it's a kind of picture into a very different ancient world where they understood things in a way far different from how we do today, right? So there's this weird, uncanny kind of strangeness to it. But really, up until the name Faust became associated with the devil's contract legend, Simon Magus was sort of the most famous of that sort of archetype. He was kind of the like standard, if not devil's contract, kind of like a cult contract figure. And you know, he's always associated with the Gnostics after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just now thinking it through, and so now obviously we're connecting it to him, and we're connecting it to Gnosticism, right? And then I'm trying to sort of frame this from the more theological or Christian perspective. And so when we think of the story just more broadly, and then this is like what I want to really ask you about, and what I want to get your thoughts on, is when you think about the story more broadly, right? So usually when you kind of have a conversation with somebody about somebody else doing something wrong, the defense that people normally have, not always obviously, but a lot of the times, is like, well, there was no malicious intent, right? Mm-hmm. So oftentimes when we see what we call evil, quote unquote, we actually see some malicious intent behind it, right? So when, like, let's say you, any portrayal, right? Like, let's say the portrayal of like Hitler, just, you know, for an easy example, right? You always see some malicious intent, right? So obviously, I mean, we all know the story. There's no need to go through it. But the point is to say there's a maliciousness behind it, right? But the interesting thing about Faust is that when you read this story, you actually see no malicious intent, right? For the most part, right? Mm-hmm. So what you're actually seeing is a person who's more or less just completely self-absorbed. So mm-hmm. when you think about evil, again, it's like it's normally viewed in this very circumspect perspective when you think about just like, oh, a person who's trying to harm other people. Whereas like when you actually read the story, and I think this is why we identify with it so much, you're seeing a person who's not so much trying to harm other people. It's more like a willful blindness toward harming other people. So would you say that when we're hearing these different narrations, and why this is so much of a lesson, is it's not so much of a lesson about, again, maliciousness, because I think that's more or less obvious to most of us, right? Especially like if there's intent there, like we kind of know, like, yeah, you shouldn't harm people on purpose. But what the authors here, you know, in these different iterations of it, is it that you think that what they're trying to tell us is it's not so much about malicious intent, it's actually more about willful blindness, and it's about living your life in such a way where now you're looking at these broader scope issues, and it's actually some of your actions are, or maybe a significant amount of your actions are actually contributing to some of these problems.
I think that that's, I think there's something to that interpretation. I mean, obviously there's some variation between legends in terms of the degree in which we can say Faust is a bad guy or not.
Right.
I will say, I think you're onto something in that I can't think of very many examples where he's like monstrous.
Right.
Like he doesn't ever quite raise to the level, you know, we don't even think this guy's, he's an alchemist and he's doing weird forbidden things and conjuring demons, and that's all bad, obviously, right? But he's rarely at a kind of sociopath, mm-hmm. serial killer level or something, right? So that's part of what I think does keep him more kind of human. I think that the idea of him as kind of being a parable about the dangers of self-absorption, I think, is really fascinating. He's definitely an ego, right? Like he's an arrogant figure. He thinks things are owed to him. He thinks he deserves more than other people. And this is, of course, I mean, that sort of narcissism or vainglory or whatever, that's very human, very modern kind of affliction to a certain extent, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I thinking back about, like, if we think of him or we think of Mephistopheles as kind of that aspect of our psyche that pulls us in that kind of direction. Because I think that's such an interesting interpretation. I mean, we can see evidence of that all the way back in the Simon Magus legend as well, right? So Simon Magus, he's not, he's the arch heretic and whatever, but he doesn't come across, at least to us in our contemporary sensibilities, as particularly malevolent, mm-hmm. Even though ancient and medieval readers may have seen him as such. And if anything, he like gets baptized, he does the right thing, but he wants like good stuff to come from him for that, right? And like that's understandable. Like people do good things and they hope good things will happen in return. It might not be the most pure way or best reason to do the good thing, and certainly not how we always do the right thing, but it's sometimes how we think about doing the right thing. If we think of Mephistopheles as an aspect of that kind of contradiction in our psyche, I think what the Simon Magus legend was so interesting is Simon Magus is paired against Saint Peter, right? But what's Peter's original name? Is Simon, right? Mm. So they're kind of, I mean, there's a way in which you can interpret that legend as being a bit of an internal battle every bit as much as some sort of external thing. Mm. So when Peter is having his, you know, prayer battle or whatever, that's not the real phrase that's used, but it's effectively what's depicted. Can we read that as like an internal struggle, as a kind of dark night of the soul between the more self-absorbed aspects of a person versus the kind of more pure, exalted aspect of the self? And I don't know. I mean, I think there's some of that in those sorts of stories.
For sure. And actually, I suppose, you know, probably, yeah, maybe a good idea to shift to this.
Wait, actually, if you're going to shift, I actually had a question for you.
Okay.
So before we shift, sure. So Alan has so for the longest time, for anybody who knows him, right, he's really big into let's say like literature on the ego. So I remember you had a really great moment where, so initially you were against it and you were like, okay, you know, there's kind of a way of chiseling away at yourself where you're sort of becoming more community oriented, you know, more so focused on other people, etc. But then you kind of had this somewhat of a turnaround moment where you thought, okay, but there are actually good aspects of the ego. So can you like tell us about that transformation? Because I think it's actually super relevant to the story.
Well, ultimately, I would say that the toxic aspects of the ego, I still agree that that's, I mean, I even said toxic. It's bad.
Right,
it's definitely bad, right? If you identify with a particular belief, you're dead set on it, and you're blinded to any other perspective, you'll fight to the death, whether metaphorically or literally. It's bad, right? Mm-hmm. You might get into arguments with people about it. It could be the reason for battles, wars, and things of that nature, for sure. Even just on an individual level, right? If you think that getting some sort of material success will complete you and fill some sort of a void, and then seeking that at the cost of actual sort of intrinsic joy, because again, we've also said this on the podcast before too, you keep saying like, if I have this, then right. I'll feel good. You keep saying like, if this happens, I'm gonna feel this way, but you keep training your brain to think that happiness lies at some sort of goalpost, as opposed to, you know, in the here and now, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Right now, what you're bringing up is what aspect of the ego is well, I would say, you know, sometimes there's character in the sense of having maybe a strong identification with a particular idea or belief or way of thinking or a way of being. Mm-hmm. And you can. There is something to that in the sense that if you meet somebody who's very, strong-willed or yeah. very, I wouldn't say rigid about a particular subject, but
has conviction.
Yeah, there can be a level of conviction from a level of identification, which technically is still ego, you know,
yeah.
as
yeah.
far as that goes. So Does that answer what
you're... Yeah. So, sure. And then I would also ask you, right? So going again back to Faust and the fact that he's not necessarily this evil person. So can we say that a lot of what Alan is describing is what people are actually seeing in this story, where it's like, on the one hand, we're saying, okay, yeah, you know, maybe according to some kind of theological traditions or some kind of cultural traditions or whatever you want to call them, like, you know, we should be kind of more grateful, right? And there's this sense that, okay, God is like, you know, all wise, all given, et cetera. Like, sort of God provides, right? And we have to be able to just, you know, humbly accept it as his servants, right? But there's also this part of us that does want to reach for the stars, you know? So like, even though, yeah, of course you could become super prideful, you know, you could become obsessed with power, yada, yada. There's also still this part of you, what? Do you want to? Okay. So there's also still this part of you that essentially says, yeah, but I still want some of these things.
I think that that's what's, yeah. I mean, I think that's what's really appealing about the legend. I think that's partially why it's endured. Is because we recognize ourselves in Faust, because it's not this kind of Manichaean good versus evil story, right? I mean, I always, I think back to a line, it's one of the funniest lines in theology, which is not a discipline known for funny lines, but in St. Augustine's Confessions, which is like arguably the first autobiography, he says, "Lord, grant me chastity, but not yet." Right? And I love that, but not yet, because it's immediately, we see this figure who's struggling and not doing so well a lot of the times. And I think that, you know, it's why I don't find kind of a lot of like superhero characters in the very, I might get into trouble for that, but like in the very kind of stereotypical sense to be, is it, or maybe why I don't find Superman to be interesting, right? Like you want your central character to have those types of flaws. Faust is one for whom those flaws feel very contemporary to us. I mean, obviously, like in, you know, Greco-Roman literature, there's many characters that have intrinsic flaws and they're interesting, but they seem sometimes like refugees from a very distant past, whereas Faust, I think, feels like our contemporary. And I think that there's a kind of like, we fear his damnation, but we're also, it's hard to judge him too much as well, lest we judge ourselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to ask is, in the context of, let's say, in the West, let's say capitalism, in what way is the Faustian bargain sort of a cautionary tale?
Well, this is one of the things that it's one of the great things about writing publicly as opposed to an academe, is I can kind of like venture all sorts of crazy arguments and no one will really stop me. And I have this argument in the book that you could say that the era in which we live is like the Faustocene, right? Mm-hmm. Like that we're all in some way Faust. And some of that, I think, goes back to the old, you know, question, is there any ethical consumption under capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. Where you do have in globalized neoliberal kind of international capitalism, we're all in some way culpable to a mm-hmm. certain extent, right? I mean, the computer I'm using to talk to you right now has, what, like cobalt in it mined from the Central African Republic, where civil wars have happened because of blah, 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 or whatever, right? Or, mm-hmm. or sweatshops or factory farms, or put your thing here.
The microphone's from Amazon.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And if it's like, if you want to live a pristine and moral life free of that, it requires, you either have to be a person who has nothing or a person who has everything, right? Like if I wanted to buy free trade everything, I'd have to have a lot more money than I have. So I think that Faust then becomes an interesting kind of parable for us today to think about our own ways in which we are culpable and how we can be responsible. It's a way in which we can like, understand that we will fall short of what is required by definition, while also kind of like measuring ourselves in ways that we can be better than we have been, I guess, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. I do think that, especially, and I talk a lot about things like nuclear proliferation and artificial intelligence and climate change, mm-hmm. And how much of those kinds of things kind of mirror what we think of in terms of the Faust legend as well. I mean, you know, climate change is a great example whereby we got a couple centuries of tremendous kind of comfort and wealth, at least in the first world, from extractive mm-hmm. industries, but they're also like destroying the planet, right? Mm-hmm. Like we all love air conditioning, mm-hmm. but or at least most of the time, I guess we do. But it has a very harsh kind of debt for the rest of the world. And I think that that kind of Faustian story tells us something about that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I wonder if there's a, going just back to the interpretation of the story itself, I wonder if there's like this sort of this sense where for Faust, again, it's not so much about, and I'm not saying that the authors intended this, by the way, I'm just wondering if we can interpret it this way, where it's not so much that these things are bad in themselves. It's more of like a Freudian interpretation is what I'm getting at. So meaning that it's like when they become sort of repressed and then become out of control is when they become bad, right? So it's like, if we're talking about something like glory, lust, pride, you know, especially, that these things are all kind of more or less natural. But the point is with somebody like Faust up until like the end of the story, which we'll obviously get into at some point, essentially there was no real, let's say, there was no containment of it, where it essentially was kind of like it was left to run amok. Mm-hmm. So when I wonder when we think of the story is when we think of the seven, is like when we think of the seven deadly sins, that we should be thinking about it in terms of excess as opposed to like categorically denying it or saying that it's categorically bad. Because, you know, the Freudians would have just said, well, of course he was like this. I mean, he repressed all of these different things. He kind of lived his life unconsciously. And of course they all kind of ran amok. He's a human being. Like there's no real other way to it. Right. So I wonder if what you're also saying is when we're talking about like climate change, as you're saying, it's not so much that industry is bad. It's just that it's bad because we've actually left out climate change and we've left out the kind of awareness of how we're affecting the world more broad.
Well, I think one of the interesting things, you know, bringing up the Seven Deadly Sins too, which is my next book coming out in November. Oh. Is, so I'll plug that as I denounce.
We'll have you back on too.
You know, one of the fascinating things with the Seven Deadly Sins as a guide to moral instruction, as opposed to the Ten Commandments, is precisely the fact that they are not blanket condemnations of any of the things that they are about. They're about excess in particular, right? So in a way, if you lived your life by trying to avoid the seven deadly sins, it's both easier and harder than the Ten Commandments, right? So the Ten Commandments has these very, like, don't kill people. Like, that's pretty easy, right? For the most part, to not do these certain things. Whereas, you know, if you're told to avoid gluttony, well, you have to eat, you know, try to avoid sloth, you have to sleep. So the question then it becomes is like, you know, how much is too much? You're kind of continually asking your questions about that, which in a way makes you more ethically and morally aware than the simpler list of like, do this, don't do that, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then it's also in a sense easier because there's more forgiveness for those sorts of things, because there's an acknowledgement that like, sometimes you're going to sleep in. Sometimes you're going to drink a little bit too much. Sometimes you're going to be in a grouchy mood, right? There's a line somewhere there where it veers into a problem, but that's a question that can be, you know, individual or can be debated or whatever. So it's a different sort of thing, I think. And, you know, the seven deadly sins were kind of in the Middle Ages. They were much more commonly the moral guide for people than the Ten Commandments were. That really happens around the Reformation. So in the 16th and 17th centuries, both Protestants and Catholics kind of re-embraced the Ten Commandments as opposed to the seven deadly sins. So I do think that you have a way in which the story about Faust is one specifically about avoiding excess. I also think what's interesting is when you talk about Freudian repression, there's a lot in that story that is also about not repressing the idea that there are darker things in the world, right? It's that the whole, you know, the cliche to give the devil his due. There's a certain amount of like taking the devil seriously and kind of honoring that, not worshiping it, obviously, but being aware that it's there, not minimizing it. Mm. And I know that some Bible scholars have argued that that's actually, to go back to Job, that's what that legend is about, that Job is so morally upstanding. He's so good that he refuses to give the devil his due. And that what's really happening there is God is saying to Satan, like, yeah, you owe what is yours, right? He has not positively genuflected before the darker things of the world in the way that one should if one wishes to be a complete human. He's basically made an idolatry out of his own goodness to a certain extent, which I don't know if that's a correct interpretation or not. But I do think in a broader sense, there's something to that idea. That if we expunge an awareness of the dark things too much, that doesn't make them go away. That just kind of pushes them down and they come up in other ways where you can't necessarily predict them or see where they're going to come from.
Right. Yeah, because toward the end of the story, I mean, there's essentially some sort of not, maybe not common ground is the right term, but there's some sort of middle ground found where, again, you see this person as a almost a completely sympathetic character. So yeah, so can we actually now go into the ending of the story? So can you tell us how it ends and why that's important?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So if we look at almost all the versions, Marlowe's included and beforehand certainly, involve Faust coming to no good end. So the demons come, they pull him down to hell. He locks himself away. He tells his students and followers, like, don't come in. You're gonna hear some fucked up shit tonight. And they do. And when they go in, he's kind of ripped apart and spread all over the room. In some of the like pamphlets, the descriptions are like incredibly gruesome. Marlowe in the stage version, it's a little less so. What's interesting in the Marlowe play is there's a huge difference between how the earlier text that was printed and the later text that was printed deal with this kind of damnation. So he goes to hell in both versions. But in the earlier one, it says if Faust could repent, right? And in the later one, it says if Faust would repent. And kind of if you go just by anal retentive close reading, that difference of one letter is so fascinating because if he could repent implies that there's nothing he could do to save himself, that's out of his hands, it's predestined, right? The would implies, even though he ultimately doesn't, that he does have a choice. He has some sort of agency or some sort of freedom there. So I think as a kind of, and I was talking earlier about how the conflicts between these two texts make them so rich to me, because there's not really an answer there, since we have two answers in the play. Later versions then will have him, I don't know if people became sympathetic or squeamish or whatnot, he will find salvation in later versions. So in the Goethe version, he's saved by the Virgin Mary comes and saves him. That actually does happen in some medieval versions of this tale as well. And that has a kind of like, I mean, I think Goethe's doing something a little bit more sophisticated, but there's arguably something about the power of God to overcome the devil, even yada yada yada, that sort of thing. But I think the version of the story that most people that feels elementally true is more the one where he ends up in hell. So I think that Marlowe version, those two kind of subtly different versions are really fascinating to me.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, in the Goethe version, I mean, essentially, there's a point in the story where there's this understanding that the reason why he doesn't deserve or have or get to eternal damnation is because there was a part of him where he, in this attempt to create a utopia, where he began to
Yeah.
focus on other people. Right. So
Exactly.
there,
Yeah.
right. So and, we again talk about so my initial interpretation where it's not malicious intent, but it's sort of a willful blindness. Where now, as he's getting away from that, there's this understanding. It's like, okay, well, we can't redeem him just because. Because of the fact that he's done these, bad things or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
But somewhere down the line, as he becomes more and more self-aware, more and more aware of how he affects obviously other people, there's a sense that there's okay, he can actually like live or he can actually kind of move on with his life because he can actually be an integral member of his community.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the ways in which the Goethe version is even more modern than the Marlowe version in some ways, right? That he's become less of a stock figure from like a medieval morality play or something. And that was Marshall Berman, who's great. I guess political theorist, literary critic, argued fundamentally that the Goethe Faust is kind of like a maybe an archetype for all of us in the modern world to some extent.
Yeah, because I think when people read these stories, rather than reading some like let's say biblical tale of punishment or whatever, that's more of like a guide in telling you what and
Yeah.
what to do and what not to do. Yeah, I think people like Rocky stories. They want like redemption tales where they have somebody who's like Rogan says this all the time. He's like, I want to hear the story of somebody who's really fucked his life up and then came back and then made it way better. For
Yeah, no, for
sure.
sure. I mean, redemption stories are a very American story too, right?
Yeah.
We love that kind of "I once was lost, but now I'm found" kind of narrative. And there, I mean, there's something generally redemptive, I think, in those stories as well, beyond the plot points, that's useful to people.
And actually, to really think about it, right, back to how the Faustian bargain is a cautionary tale, right? So I suppose in light of sort of modern innovations, right, which are mentioned in the book, like let's say AI, social media in general, actually, right? I suppose where we could see how we're sort of trading our soul or our morals is in the sense of at least let's say AI, right? At least how I'm trying to sort of parse this out. AI sounds awesome, right? We have ChatGPT. You can ask it a question. You can feed it a document. You can ask it to do all sorts of things for you. It's super convenient. I love it personally. Absolutely. Now, I suppose if we were to think sort of long term, and you know, there's that narrative of, okay, AI taking jobs and that sort of thing. Well, then, yes, you know, we're trading that innovation for potentially people, you know, being out of work in the right. future. That's
for
that's,
the convenience of some.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And then in the context of, let's say, social media, in what way are they trading their morals or soul, so to speak? I suppose if somebody's trying to make the most viral video in order to get success as quickly as possible, perhaps whatever integrity that they, well, I suppose it depends what kind of content you're trying to make, mm-hmm.
but
you're trading essentially integrity for the ability to sort of grab attention as quickly as possible, I suppose, depending on what you're trying to communicate, mm-hmm. at least in the context of the news, then yes, you'll have sensationalized headlines that will maybe cause a fear response in someone in order to get their attention and in order to be first, when, you know, you could argue is that necessary or not necessary, it does have an effect on people, mm-hmm. right? As you mentioned in the book, totalitarian regimes like Nazi Germany, Stalinist Russia, I mean, they promised this sort of utopic vision, but at the cost of so many lives, you know, for that vision.
Yeah, willful right? blindness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Nuclear proliferation, right? So Oppenheimer helping to invent the atomic sure. bomb. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, okay, yes, we did have a way to win the war, right? At least, you know, for the Allies, for the Americans, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. But now we've invented this new massive killing device that now a whole bunch of countries have access to. And who knows?
And they can never go away, right? Like that's once that's there, that's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I suppose why I brought it up, I suppose, is just to sort of highlight, you know, like, wow, this is actually super relatable to modern times. And just it's something that we should really take into consideration. And also individually, right? Oh, yeah, capitalism was brought up earlier, right? Yeah. So chasing the American dream. We're convinced that money equals success, right? And that we're essentially in competition with our fellow men. At least the structure is mm-hmm. that way. Mm-hmm. Some sure. people might think differently, but that's how it's structured. Okay, well then, now you're putting in all these hours at work in order to achieve this money and this success, but what's the opportunity cost? Maybe mm-hmm. time with your family or time that you could do something that you're genuinely interested in. If it's somebody who's in a job that they're doing just for the money and they're giving, whether it's 8 or 8+ hours per day, essentially 5 days a week on average, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the time, I don't know. It's almost like a groundhog day for some of those people too.
Sure.
And yeah, it's very interesting. Like, you know, what our values are in terms of like what we trade to get this thing that we think we want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're sort of posed with that question dozens of times a day. Right. And
yeah.
sometimes we give in, sometimes we don't, you know, I think that's sort of the interesting thing about it is that few of us are ever Faust all the time, but all of us are Faust some of the time. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. do you think, Ed, that there was a point in the story where he actually, you know, in some interpretations at least, where he was able to overcome some of that just like sort of doggedness and that hyper-focus on short-term thinking?
Interesting. I mean, certainly, like, I think in the Goethe version, right, when he kind of has the singular moment where he feels like that human connection and that kind of derives his salvation. The earliest versions now, I think in the earliest versions, but he's more of like a stock character in those pamphlets. And those pamphlets, I mean, they're fun reading. They're like gothic horror reading, but it's basically like, don't do magic. You know what I mean? Mm-mm. I think Marlowe, by making him a more textured and complicated multidimensional figure, maybe by definition, there's kind of an indication that he could have done things differently. There's that could there. But I don't think that character as described in that play would have been one that would have. I think that kind of took some time to develop a version of Faust who's truly capable of deserving a type of redemption. Maybe waited till Goethe, I guess, for that to come along.
And so before we wrap up, I also wanted to mention, it's so cool that you actually also wrote an article on Viktor Frankl. So we have like, kind of contrast between the two, right? So we have obviously Faust, who's kind of more or less egocentric, right? And then, you know, Viktor Frankl, who was, I mean, obviously we kind of like glorify him in some ways, but he was more or less way more altruistic. So can you just tell us about your background and your interest in him? Because I'm super curious. So I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm an existentialist, and I love logotherapy.
Yeah, so Viktor Frankl, I think what I love about Viktor Frankl, and I think I may have quoted him a few other pieces, but I wrote one piece for Eon like 3 or 4 years ago. It was right around the time the pandemic started, so it kind of was like appropriately, not intentionally timed for that, but it kind of worked. And I find Frankl and logotherapy to be so interesting because Frankl places meaning at the center of his sense of what's important to people. And I think that he is a figure for whom he's very much asking the right questions. And I think that meaning is a word that we oftentimes forget when we're sort of talking about contemporary politics or culture or whatever. I think material conditions are incredibly important, obviously. But I think a sense of significance, a sense of meaning, a sense of being part of something bigger than yourself, I think that those are intrinsic human qualities. And sometimes you can go the Faustian route and sell your soul to the devil to find meaning. And sometimes you can find it in the more altruistic kind of way that Frankl recommended. But I think being able to recognize that you have a need that is kind of independent of the body to a certain extent, that is this kind of ineffable meaning, is really, really important and kind of the beginning of talking about anything with human motivation.
Yeah, and I think if anything, you can make the case that with Faust, he never really, again, because he was so hyper focused on pleasure, success, etc., that meaning was never really, if it was even a forethought, you know, at some point, right? But at least in the beginning, it wasn't. So, and I love that you mentioned Bedazzled, because in that, I'm not sure whether you were referencing the 90s version or the 60s version with Dudley Moore.
I think I mentioned the 60s version, and then maybe like a parenthetical or a footnote or something.
Yeah.
The second one is that Elizabeth Hurley?
Brendan Fraser. So what's interesting about that is that, like, in both movies, essentially, like, he never really gets the thing that he wants. And I think essentially maybe there's some implicit commentary. I mean, maybe I'm just like looking into it too much or reading into it too much, but like there's no actual purpose, right? And essentially what I think maybe implicitly, again, the story is trying to tell you is that it's like, if you're grasping for pleasure, I mean, it's always going to recede in the distance, like the Gatsby story, you know, toward the end, right? Where we're always kind of like, you know, as we're moving forward in some sense, you know, pleasure or success or whatever, it's sort of receding into the distance, right? So do you find that that's kind of the case with like Bedazzled, Faust, whatever, you know, whichever kind of interpretation you want to use, or whichever iteration that you want to use, is that we're fundamentally saying, if you're spending a life solely pursuing pleasure, you're never really going to get it. You're never going to fully grasp it. It's always going to be kind of vacuous, at least to some, not even to some degree, I would say to some significant degree.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sort of speaking outside my field right now, but like Kierkegaard has that whole thing where he talks about like the aesthetic man and the which I think is like the man of pleasure, and it was like a moral man and so on. And I think that I do think that intrinsic to the Faust myth is definitely something about the ephemerality of, you know, pleasure or power or money or even knowledge, right, as opposed to wisdom and contentment and morality, kindness and what have you. I think that that's a central aspect of the legend.
All right, man, such a great point to end off on. Before we actually do go, Alan, final questions for Ed?
Yes, if we wanted to follow your work and of course buy the book when it comes out July 9th, where can we do that?
I'm no longer on Twitter or X or whatever. But I do have a website that I maintain. It's edsimon.org. So I'm like an organization, apparently. the book's available wherever books are sold. It's published by, I've always wanted to say that. It's published by Melville House, distributed by Penguin Random House. So it'll be available at like Barnes & Noble and what have you. It's on the Rainforest website online as well. So you can go to Amazon and pick up a copy there.
All right. Awesome. And thank you so much for coming on, man. This was excellent. Super insightful.
Awesome. Thanks so much. I really appreciate being asked.
Absolutely, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thanks. I'll see you. Bye.
Bye.
All right. That was awesome. So Everyone, if you'd like to follow us, you can follow us at Seize the Moment Podcast on Facebook and on Instagram. On Twitter, we're at Seize_podcast. Like, subscribe,
hit the bell on YouTube.
And again, thank you so much for watching and see you next time.